Okay, so it's 10 minutes after 5, approximately, and we're resuming our conversation. And you had a few extra minutes to think about the question I posed.
And the question was, what could be done differently?
Right. With again, sort of the different cultures, the different risk appetites of investment banks versus traditional commercial banks, and how, you know, you can plainly see sort of the profitability motive and desire to generate returns for both shareholders and for managers driving investment bankers to try and be first and taking ever larger risk exposures.
So, I mean, I think about in the context of sort of what are you charging for the risk internally, either capital or liquidity, balance sheet usage? Do you have an awareness by legal vehicle and the organization as a whole? So, for example, you know, thinking through the incremental. So we think about it on a consolidated basis, the incremental increase in balance sheet, the composition of the capital, and we can break it down into the bank entity and the consolidated. It's also helpful to understand the intercompany transactions that are taking place. I mean, what was struck me on reflection is all the legal vehicles involved and the flows, and thinking through at the different stages if things go bad. I think that's what, you know, we alluded to a little bit when we talked earlier about, if you look about the subprime exposure on balance sheet, but there's lots of subprime exposure, even though you're not originating the loans. They package them. They were the arranger. They were looking at index. You know, they were gearing off of indexes. If you think about it in the CDO context. So I think it's both their internal risk management. I mean, there's a...
I would just restate what you're saying, which is just so slightly different, which is when someone is doing something in a more complex way than it might otherwise be done, you know, ask yourself why. So if you're going to securitize a bunch of mortgage-backed securities, and, you know, a bunch of mortgages, that's not a new activity for most organizations. It's securitization technology is decades old. But then you take pieces of it and lay it off into this vehicle or do that or the other thing. You know, ask yourself why, and then to Diane's point, you know, is this a capital arbitrage, which is effectively what's occurring here? And if that's the answer, then I think you need to do a lot of work to determine whether the risk is commensurate with the arbitraged, you know, location of the risk. I'm sorry, of the capital. Let me say that differently. That however this is being done, whether the amount of capital that's being held against that activity is commensurate, you know, with the level of risk in the activity. So in other words, ask yourself a simple question, which is, if you have an outlet that allows you to do something in a certain way, and you say, well, this is a lot more complicated than I might otherwise do it for various reasons, and because it affects my leverage ratio, and it's easier this way because I can deconsolidate it, or, you know, I only have to hold 15 basis points of capital against something versus 400 basis points, you know, just because that's allowable, like, you know, is that actually the right answer? And then, you know, I would add to that, in terms of capital arbitrage, I think firms need to think really, really carefully about the transfer pricing for liquidity support. I just think that's, you know, really, really clear here. You know, through this entire event, people gave away the liquidity support very, very cheap. You know, that was a function of a flat yield curve for a long time, and just historically, you know, how people did things, and that's not necessarily a good reason for how to do it going forward. So. Pricing for capital and liquidity, like, really, really important. I also think that in terms of, you know, other things that have occurred, you know, that we've seen in places, in terms of the amount of reserves people hold against various things, there's limitations because of the accounting standards. I think that those limitations, for instance, which are designed to be offset in Basel II. So, for instance, if your loan loss reserve is X, but Basel II, the loan related, the losses model under Basel II would be X plus something. The way Basel II works, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, you actually have to hold the difference in capital. That becomes part of your capital requirement. I think that's actually very much something that we could that could be done going forward, methodically. I'm sorry, I have a cold. That's why I keep.
Yeah. I was going to say, me too. I think it's allergies. Because I have this little tickle in my throat. Upon reflection, I think that firms talk about their capital and funding positions. It's this calculation of how your balance sheet is going to change and your contingent is going to change. It's sort of you do the business and you figure out what the impact is. And it's almost as if doing the business are all the questions that we've just talked about. What balance sheet, liquidity, capital, why? Why so complex? What does this mean if things were to go haywire for our additive? It's like every incremental decision is the additive, not rather than let's give it a chance and see if the business can grow, but constrain it in a way that, they're thinking about the financial implications, the legal, the reputational, what are the consequences we may, what are the actions we may take under what circumstances if, for example, we've got a number of investors who are important to us as an organization that we want to accommodate, as would be the case if you were, purchasing CP for someone. I mean, those types of things, I think, have to be factored in, should be factored in more routinely.
And then I would just, there's only a couple other things I would add. I think firms have a very difficult time answering the question of what if across the financial system. I don't think they have that capability per se to do that. They can try to ask those questions, but without knowing what their position is vis-a-vis all the other financial concerns that they're in the market with, it's really, really difficult to make that that leap. But I think there's a really, that's an important role for us to play, really, to be able to look quantitatively across the financial system and say, if X occurs, that's going to be an iterative process, but if X occurs, here's the risk to the system. And I think if you rewind time and have that as an outlook and looked at exposures that people talked about in the past, commercial real estate for one, right. There's a lot to talk about that, and two, sort of, in terms of people knew underwriting standards were, people knew the subprime market was evolving in a particular way. Like, saying we're going to look at this quantitatively across the financial system, and not limit it to a small number of core banks, but look at it across every firm that has a touch point. I think you would have ferreted these issues out much earlier. Then would have let things, or promulgated a set of standards or structures to the market that would have put the right incentives back into the system.
So are you saying that we need more transparency, not just for individual institutions, but for the financial system as a whole? Is that a fair paraphrasing?
I think the financial system has evolved to a point that's so complicated that focusing on core banks is just not a useful exercise if you want to do this kind of work, which I think there's a complete consensus that you want to do it. You've got to look at big hedge funds who are involved and how they're feeding the cycle. You need to look at, all sorts of, off-balance sheet entities. You need to look at the organizations themselves. And then I think you need to pose sort of a very broad question to people, which is, if X occurred, how will that affect you, both directly, both direct financial effects, indirect financial effects, and reputational risk. And when I say direct, I mean, look at Citi. They held X quantity of subprime mortgages. Great. indirect effects. I've got these liquidity puts. I don't see this concentration because it's kind of here. And one organization says they can't look at it, and the other one says they can't look at it, and you would have ferreted that out. And then you ask yourself the reputational effects, right? You know, people are going to come back to you and put paper to you, and they're going to say, you either buy this back from me or I'm going to stop funding you here, 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 and here. Then you got to ask yourself the most difficult question, which is, all right, once you do that analysis, is it too much risk for the system to bear? And what's driving that? And, you know, I think that's really straight. That's really clear that that has to be done going forward. I mean, people cannot view themselves as marginal participants because in the crisis they're not marginal anymore. They all collectively are the market.
And how much faith or comfort do you have in modeling techniques?
Fair value? You mean?
Or just in general?
Just in yeah. General as a means of measuring risk.
So I think about it lots of different ways. So accounting permits, there are assets that just don't have a market for, and you can model level 3 assets.
Right.
And that bakes into the balance sheet and then in turn the capital. There are, what I have come to appreciate, banks will be subject to a regulatory framework, many, depending upon the countries they operate. They'll have a proprietary capital framework. So the regulatory framework will say, we want you to be a going concern. The proprietary capital framework, economic capital, will say, we want you to survive with $1 left over. The rating agencies will say, we want you to have a managed assets view if you're a big credit card bank, and we want you to have a tangible common equity perspective. And then there's probably a lot of other, I think each of them, the key is what's the objective, what's the question the model's trying to answer, and the model is but a guide, and you've got to think about all of them in harmony. Or you know, what is the limitation of each? What does the sum total tell you? And then what is it that you're not, what's the model error in the models that you're using, and what are you just not capturing altogether? And that's how you should be thinking. We should be thinking about it from a supervisory perspective, and then not only in good times, but in adverse times. So sort of, what is it that you as a firm could go under? What could happen to the market that could shut you out? What could you do that could have a knock-on effect with others? And then what's common to your business relative to other institutions that we need to be concerned about? I'm sure firms are saying that sounds like a lot, but if we ruled the day, I think that it's extremely important, and we've seen it countless times because we had, you know, in the recent 18 months or so.
There's so many other things that have to be fixed.
Yeah.
It's just where to start.
Okay.
No, it's just enormous.
Yeah.
And then these comments are all geared towards, you know, the financial institutions themselves. There's a lot of structural fixes. Dan, what was the minimum? What was the city's minimum tier one?
Their target?
No, what was their minimum actual? At any point during the crisis, what was the minimum?
Oh, so this is another. I think it might have gone in the leaks. Just below 7.5 in terms of a tier one risk-based requirement. So that's another, you know, thing that clearly...
Think about that for a minute.
Yeah, market capitalization, or the market had a different view from all the different market indicators than the regulatory capital suggests. And I think that speaks a little bit to, obviously there are changes underway to fortify risk capture. And
right.
Also quantity and quality of capital matters. So
right.
Those are things we're very aware of. But I think it's, again, there's not just one tool that's one indicator. Regulatory capital is one indicator. There are many others that should be relied upon for looking through into the intrinsic condition of a firm.
I'm a net tangible leverage ratio guy myself.
Tangible common equity, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, in fairness, the tier one RBC does throw out a ton of intangibles.
It does.
I mean, it throws out the deferred tax assets.
For them, yeah.
Goodwill is stripped out. I think the main intangible that's usually part of RBC is mortgage servicing rights.
Right.
Which actually, it's a real, that's. I mean, they call it an intangible, but it's a real asset. I mean, no more, you know, no more unreal than a receivable on a set of swaps contracts. So
I drafted the legislation to throw it out of capital in 89.
That's
ours?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not going to convince you. But, you know, this was an organization that had a real level of risk-based capital.
Right.
You know, well in excess any like, you know, view of, I mean, I don't know, Diane, future losses, so.
Right, no, I agree, and I think.
The market zeroed on them, and, you know.
Well, we're almost done here, so let me move on. One more document, okay. Maybe two. F46 now. Bates 819 to 821. Since we've been talking about capital, that's what this.
Okay.
On the eve of the liquidity freeze, that's what this letter.
Okay. You can see only my part of the fruit plate.
Go. Enjoy it. No one else will.
So I'm interested, sort of generally, in your explanation of sort of risk, the effectiveness of risk capital as it's used here as a tool, mm-hmm. And in particular, if you have any comments on the sort of the fat tail discussion on page 2.
Is it the scaling for market risk capital?
Yeah.
So, do you want me to talk to this?
Well, I will speak to risk capital generally, and I'll let you speak to the fat tail. Divide and conquer. Yeah. So risk capital was their internal name for economic capital. And I do not know if this was part of it was a horizontal. So there was an initiative underway, including Citi and others, to assess the effectiveness of their economic capital frameworks. And I think my recollection's right. At some point in the past, there was a lot of focus on economic capital. It's an alternative for capturing risk. We had concerns about what the model was calibrated to and also diversification benefits. So, for example, a firm could say, the perspective was, how many resources do I need to my risk on a diversified basis? How much capital do I need? Usually a lot less than what regulatory capital would have required, because they would say, because I have a hedge fund business and a CDO business and a consumer lending business, that creates a lot of synergies. My net risk of all things were to go bad is much less, and therefore I need less resources. I think also at one point we had, which we've since evolved our thinking, when you think about the capital adequacy process or capital planning process of a firm, they should rely on all these different tools for determining what their capital targets and liquidity targets should be. And we place a lot greater emphasis at some point in the past on the strength of the economic capital process as a complement to the regulatory framework, thinking that the economic capital proprietary models would reveal something or some model error that the regulatory framework would have missed or inadequately captured.
Yeah, and in general, I always think of the economic capital models as a robustness check to, you know, the risk management, the other risk management processes that the firm has. So, you know, if you have a qualitative, you know, one of the lessons here is a really simple one, which is, like, you know, good risk management is quantitative and absolutely rigorously qualitative. And to the point we were talking earlier about data aggregation, good data aggregation supports qualitative risk measurement. So if you have good data, it's an opportunity to, you know, in a more nuanced way, think about what-if questions. So EC is a good way to say, if you do that exercise in what if X, Y, and Z occurred. What if, for instance, Moody's get an S&P and Fitch get it all completely wrong, and this, all these things happen. You know, what are the, and you sort of come up with a, you know, expert judgment of what that looks like, and then you compare it to your EC model. Are you in the same ballpark? Is this way smaller than that? Is this way bigger? I mean, this is like you start to triangulate, you know, and get a robustness check. Let me tell you what that particular paragraph means.
Okay.
I want you to think about an upside down, think about an options portfolio that has an upside down U P&L distribution to it related to the underlying. So sort of on the horizontal, you have the equity price movement. Let's just pick the S&P 500. And on the vertical, you have negative P&L and positive P&L. And so you have an upside-down U-shaped options portfolio. That's easy to construct. You could do that. And so if you calculate, can I just put something on the board
sure.
for you really quick?
Get more grapes.
So this is P&L here. And we'll just call that X. And I construct a risk portfolio like this. And this is my confidence interval. And I calculate you know, the P&L here. And then I scale. I'm like, it's hard for me to draw this. You see this change in P&L right here?
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, if I take this P&L and multiply it by, let's say, a factor of, I'll make this up, 100 to get a higher confidence interval. All I've done is multiply, let's say, 1 times 100. Okay?
Go.
This would, let's say, be the change in P&L at that confidence interval. And the real P&L effect from here to here is not 100 times the 1. It's like 10,000 times that. That's what they're talking about. Scaling from a smaller confidence interval to a larger one when you have non-linear portfolios is extremely... You can run into a real underassessment of risk. And unless you do... I actually don't remember this... exam, but unless you do some kind of one-off validation to show you that your portfolio doesn't exhibit that, you don't know what even the error is in your estimate of risk when you scale something up. So it could be that you're actually, your portfolio, well, let's make this up, is really flat like that and doesn't exhibit a portfolio or a P&L shape like that. In this case, if that's your quick way of doing calculating something, because it's cheaper to do this, it doesn't take 25 quants, 10 years to do, and you burn all your computer time, that's okay. But if your portfolio looks like something like this, you're in a whole different world.
Right.
And that's what that comment in general refers to.
Okay.
Can you tell he's a quant guy or what?
Yeah.
this is not a quant guy.
Yeah.
No, okay.
No comment isn't, but that is.
Last document.
Okay.
47, the operations review report.
From what year?
2005.
Okay.
90706 to 90740. We're marking as F47. And it's dated May 9th to 27, 2005. Hmm. And I guess I'm interested in a section on page 28. The LCBO supervision, just a couple of paragraphs. Thank you. So do you recall receiving, were you made available of this report back in 2005? Was it shared with you?
I do not recall receiving it, no.
Okay. With respect to that first paragraph where it says recommendation, I can represent to you that I've read the document, draft, closeout report, and the LCBO team that it's referencing here is the Citigroup team.
Okay.
And it was only like three or four sentences, but it said essentially that because of all the various compliance issues that had popped up with Citigroup, that there was a lot of focus on attempting to determine, you know, are they complying with C&D, are they complying with the written agreement, are they complying, and that there wasn't enough resources, in their view, to do the adequate job of the continuous monitoring function. Was that communicated to you back in 2005?
I do not. I know we talked a lot about, I don't recall this specific comment, but we talked a lot about how are we going to carry out our mission. I know that there was discussion, there's always discussion back and forth about team size. And what does it mean to say who is on a dedicated team and what resources can you draw from? And that's, you know, do you like salt or do you like pepper? That seems to be a discussion that we have, that I recall coming around many times. To this specific point, what we did is had a dedicated monitoring team for the CND. They were a set of risk examiners, a very skilled corporate compliance examiner. And he was assisted, I can't recall by how many, but he was the dedicated person to run those exams. I think there were five or six phases over multiple years with scopes that were vetted, very detailed structure around it that we worked on with our management here and with at the board and legal to say, were these the right things we were testing? Then we had a program. We had a separate set of risk examiners. Bard was one of them at the time, and he had a few people working with him to work exclusively on the written agreement. We were doing that in conjunction with the other firm.
J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan. Okay, so I figured, but there was a, because they were under similar written agreements, we were making sure that we felt it important to have consistency in approach and make sure that we were testing rigorously and had similar expectations. So that was a different team. We also then brought on someone, Glenn Schneider, actually, was the point to manage the, there were a number of commitments, if I recall, related to First American Bank, which led to the ban on mergers and acquisitions. And so his remit was to monitor those things that fell outside of the C&D in the written agreement.
Right.
So I would say, yes, was the, you know, could a handful of individuals do all of that on a team, manage all of it? No, but our model was to draw from the risk examiners. And as long as we articulated our case and said, this is what our time commitment is, here's the skill set, we made it everybody aware that we felt this was a priority and kept nudging if for some reason there was someone who didn't think it was, we got what we needed to do the job. But I would say if you looked at the, on the roll-up exam, it only lists 12 of us. Well, that's a little deceiving because there's actually a whole remit, you know, Steve's group, credit risk, whatever. We have a claim on those resources as long as, and we would talk about prioritization and, you know, what was the issue of the day. That was my perspective. I do recall.
It was like the PD program you could get people from, wouldn't show up on your role.
Yeah, we would have, PD were people who had extensive professional development, prior professional experience who were coming into the bank new, so we could use them in some capacity. We could also then rely on the more seasoned examiners for scheduled periods of time.
So thinking sort of outside of the box, and I hate that phrase, but in looking at the structure of the Federal Reserve System, I think the number and location of banks dates back to how soon you could haul currency, you know, by rail to a bank.
It's also political.
Yeah. That's right.
There were a lot more people in the Midway, a lot more
right.
congressmen.
I bet, yeah.
Right. Yeah, St. Louis always seems to, no matter, it's like right. something always gets put there.
Yeah, it's been in Mississippi.
Yeah. With one bank in California, and like God knows how many in the Midwest.
Yeah. Right. But now you've got the bank supervision group resources of the Federal Reserve System. I think if you look at the numbers, I can't remember the specifics. I think it's around 2,600-2,700 people in the BSGs across the 12 banks. If you look at the six largest commercial banking entities, commercial bank organizations, including holding companies, there's such a huge chunk of the risk in the assets, however you want to cut it. If one was designing...
I think your question is, it's the most complexity is what the important thing is. It's not mass.
Right.
It's complexity.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. If one were designing a system, you know, even if you've got triple the resources, you've got 30, you know, whatever. To me, that doesn't look like enough compared to the resources that are being spent in, say, Montana on supervising banks. That you know. The issues are so complicated here, the risks are so large here, that the resource allocation just sort of on its face makes me puzzled.
And I've been thinking a lot about this. So let's just say you had 30 full-time equivalents. That might be about 100 or 200 persons from around the system. So we would have, I don't know how it came about, but Philadelphia happens to have a consumer credit expertise, and corporate lending happens to be in the West, and Chicago has commercial real estate, and Boston has operational risk. I do not know how they developed, but we would call upon those individuals to join us, confer with us, do, lack of a better term, continuous monitoring, desk reviews, analytical work. Attached by a conference call or applying for a meeting. So I think it understates there is a lot of touch from a lot of experts from around the system. Do they do it on a full-time basis? No. But would Citi or another large institution be one of the factors that, one of the institutions that they were focused on? Yes. I agree, though. I mean, you know, sure, if you had more individuals dedicated on a full-time basis, there are pros and cons to that. I think what we try to strive for is different perspectives being brought to the table, not the first time, but having, you know, a perspective on the firm as it evolved. And that's why I think it's multidisciplinary, if you will, is kind of what I'm grappling with. I think that's very important.
When I talked with... And you'll get your chance.
I don't know if you're huffing because you agree. Or
I agree with that.
Yeah.
When I talked with Scott Waterhouse, he said there were approximately 50 people from the OCC on site at Citi, and he said, look, we can't hope to sort of look at things on the first order basis. We have to rely on the risk management people at Citigroup. And that they're, you know, in that organization, I guess there are like 2,500 people in risk management. And the question is, I mean, is that really how you want to design supervision of complex organizations where you have no choice but to rely on their own risk management?
So what I would say is, and I think SCAP kind of bore this out, you need to have an independent analysis. That said, we don't run the business and we don't generate the data. But we can have a view based on what we observe of the strength of their controls and trying to get a feel for the risks as they are today and how they may go awry, and then put it through our perspective of, is that conservative enough? We always are going to have a different perspective than the management team. So that doesn't seem sufficient. We need them to hold more capital, more liquidity. But I would say it's a complement of, yes, you have to rely on their systems and what they're doing, not exclusively. And that's why we have a lot of the monitoring programs and experts that we have, because they're monitoring market developments. Does this strike us as credible, best practice, should be refined, draw the line that what they're doing is just completely unsafe and unsound?
Was my turn. I don't want to stop yet.
Yeah.
No, I think that think it, first of all, I think all the number the numbers can be really misleading when you look at the number of people dedicated to things, because it's really a function of what you do, what you choose to focus on, not how many people you have to focus on something. You can implement a supervision program that highly mimics the internal audit function of an organization. There's really, that's going to yield different results than if you build a system that does something very different. And in terms of, I'll just emphasize too that Diane mentioned, I don't think we simply have, I think even looking at the other reserve banks, we also have to think about what the markets group here in New York brings to the table in terms of their conversations with folks, and then the level of integration you have with research, right? I mean, amongst those different participants and what we can draw on around from around the Federal Reserve, I think that is that there's a real, to my mind, there's a very large strength there that, like, the number of people on a specific team would never convey to somebody. All right. In addition to that, I think the question is, what is your objective in supervision? And, you know, that is a huge, huge driver in what you choose to focus on and what you'll eventually decide needs to be corrected in the organization. And I think I would say before, like, looking at the system as a whole with new market participants, financial technologies that are new, you put that all together, that leads you to ask a set of questions and focus on things that are very different than you might otherwise. And that is how you'll be in a position to deter the next, systemic crisis. I just said it's that simple.
Yeah, I think just reflecting on wearing different hats since the time that I spent as the CPC for Citi, I saw our ability to draw from our perspective on thinking about an institution, what other institutions were doing, the market, how that fit in with the other operations that we have as a central bank, and getting different perspectives was extremely helpful and helped us more quickly when problems started unfolding with such magnitude, get a better feel for what the issues are, what we needed to do. And often, I would say that our colleagues at the OCC and other agencies often were asking for help in thinking through the issues. So it was most powerful for me, the benefits of not just having an audit-related perspective, but this broader perspective.
And so I guess my final question, and I'm not sure either one of you was there for the right time period, but I'm interested why the MOU form was chosen for the enforcement device in the spring of 08 instead of...
The written agreement?
Yeah. Or C&D. I mean, City Financial... which one can argue is a much smaller scope problem, culminated in a cease and desist order. Whereas, I think the number, the amount of losses, depending on how you...
Yeah, I could answer it too. Go
ahead. Let me give you and I think I'm glad you asked this question, because it's something I really want to stress about Citigroup that I think is very important. If you look at the playbook of a troubled institution, I can tell you, and you can ask very senior people here who have far more longevity than I do, and this may even be consistent with your own experience. First of all, a troubled institution, it's often management that's at the core of the problem, and it's often that's the toughest problem to crack at the organization. They either have a very compliant board, management's responsible for the issue, they won't take the necessary action to solve the problem. Citi did not do that. They changed management rapidly. I mean, Prince, the board changes that were made when Bischoff coming in, you have you have a new chief risk officer, You know, Crittenden was relatively new. Vikram came in. You just had a very aggressive cleaning out of the senior management folks at the organization. They took that step very early. They were aggressive at raising capital. They raised capital in both late 07. I think they did a capital raise, this is my memory's lapse now, early 08, and then again in May of 08. Those are two very aggressive actions they took. There was also a very aggressive set of internal fixes they did, some of which I mentioned, in terms of better financial controls vis-a-vis transfer pricing. During this period of time, they significantly enhanced, they were working on enhancing their liquidity position and had an aggressive deleveraging plan. Those are things that that's the playbook for a troubled institution. And, you know, hard-pressed to say we need to, you know, push this organization even harder than those actions. They had a lot of work to do. There's no question about it. My own view would have been, and I think people here in general, more senior to me, agreed, and I'm here and at the board when I say that, a written agreement, which would have been public, would have been counterproductive to that. That's what we would have done if we had a recalcitrant organization that wasn't owning up to its problems and taking aggressive actions. And a cease and desist is just a written agreement with some extremely, you know,
punitive measures built on. Usually we use those in court to attach a civil money penalty. That's generally the rule. It's not always. We've done civil money penalties on written agreements, but general course is cease and desist goes with money. And for obvious reasons, there's no point in fining City at that particular moment.
And then I think, you know, thereafter, you know, I believe City was trapped in what was a pretty vicious financial system, a systemic event. And they were, you know, I mean, there had been firms that had failed earlier than that. The people were moving simply up the rungs of the ladder. You know, City was, you know, deemed to be weak, as it was, in a weakened condition. You know, at that point, I'm just going to be blunt, you know, the traditional playbook was used. It was time to come up with a new playbook for a situation that I don't think many people, and unless you're going to, you know, I don't know what happened in 1929, but, you know, I wasn't around then, and I haven't read any bank supervisor playbooks that I just, you know, you'll have to tell, you know, we did what we needed to do, and obviously, you guys know, read the paper as well as we did, so.
Well, unless you guys have anything else you want to say, I've exhausted my list of questions. I'd like to thank you for your time, your candor, and cooperation.
Can I ask a silly academic question? Because it's a small debate that's been going around in the office, and it got picked up for 2 seconds. Special purpose entities, so things that are held off balance sheet. Other than the fact that they're bankruptcy remote, do you see any economic value in their creation at all? Besides the capital arbitrage?
Well, you're aware that under FAS 166 and 167, that those are mostly on balance sheet now.
Right. No, and so
economic benefit in terms of risk transfer?
Is there anything that is accomplished by moving it off by moving it off balance sheet that could not otherwise be done holding the same things on the balance sheet?
I think there's a lot of, and I think this is the key, that there are low risk transactions that are prohibitively expensive to do on a bank's balance sheet. Because the capital rules are not sufficiently subtle to reflect those distinctions. And to the extent that those activities move to an off-balance sheet vehicle with appropriate capital structure, I mean, think about a situation where someone can't get financing. If something's truly low risk, but the capital accord says, gee, you're just like a bunch of high-risk transactions, and we don't yet distinguish the difference between those two things. So that's real social utility. The question is, when you take something high risk and are able to put it in that type of an entity and hold little capital against it, I think there's a social cost to that.
Okay. And I think, so, just to elaborate on Steve's point, for small entities that aren't able to access the capital markets, being able to sell a traditional receivable into an SPV that can issue CP and get you funding on an off season, particularly if you're a cyclical retail or a really small corporation, there's, I agree, a lot of social utility. Okay. And that you're allowing credit intermediation. The problem is that when it moves beyond,
right,
and it's not collateralized and got a historical, you know, good underwriting, historical returns, when that balance, yeah, when that balance goes awry, then it's not all the things that we saw can occur.
Okay.
That would be my...
No, that's actually great.
So, no,
that's exactly what I was going to hear.
No, you really got to worry that if you just, you know, do away with this form of finance, you will leave, you will actually leave a lot of folks who are creditworthy loans you would make with just no access.
Oh, I don't think that was the implication.
No, but it is, yeah, a broad approach to...
Because it came up in the wake of Enron. I mean, there was a lot of talk about whether we should just do away with off-balance sheet.
Right. I think, again, it's the purpose and, you know...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 6 in the...